The custard was sweet and creamy in my mouth. The dark swollen currants in the spotted dick were tangy in the cake-thick, chewy blandness of the pudding. And perhaps I was going to die that night, and perhaps I would never go home again, but it was a good dinner. And I had faith in Letty Hempstock. The world outside the kitchen was still waiting. The Hempstock's fog-coloured house cat, I do not believe I ever knew her name, padded through the kitchen. That reminded me. "Mrs. Hempstock, is the kitten still here? The black one with the white ear?"
"Not tonight," said Ginny Hempstock. "She's out and about. She was asleep on the chair in the hall all this afternoon."
I wished I could stroke her soft fur. I wanted, I realized, to say goodbye.
I suppose, if I do have to die tonight, I started, haltingly, not sure where I was going. I was going to ask for something, I imagine, for them to say goodbye to my mummy and daddy, or to tell my sister that it wasn't fair that nothing bad ever happened to her, that her life was charmed and safe and protected while I was forever stumbling into disaster. But nothing seemed right, and I was relieved when Ginny interrupted me.
"Nobody is going to die tonight," said Ginny Hempstock firmly. She took my empty bowl and washed it out in the sink. Then she dried her hands on her apron. She took the apron off, went out into the hallway, and returned a few moments later, wearing a plain brown coat and a pair of large dark green Wellington boots. Letty seemed less confident than Ginny, but Letty, with all her age and wisdom, was a girl, while Ginny was an adult, and her confidence reassured me. I had faith in them both.
"Where's old Mrs. Hempstock?" I asked.
"Having a lie down," said Ginny. "She's not as young as she used to be."
"How old is she?"
I asked, not expecting to get an answer. Ginny just smiled, and Letty shrugged. I held Letty's hand as we left the farmhouse, promising myself that this time I would not let it go.
Chapter 14. When I had entered the farmhouse, through the back door, the moon had been full, and it was a perfect summer's night. When I left, I went with Letty Hempstock and her mother out of the front door, and the moon was a thin white smile, high in a cloudy sky, and the night was gusty with sudden undecided spring breezes coming first from one direction, then from another. Every now and again, a gust of wind would contain a sprinkling of rain that never amounted to anything more than that. We walked through the manure-stinking farmyard and up the lane. We passed a bend in the road, and we stopped. Although it was dark, I knew exactly where I was. This was where it had all begun. It was the corner where the opal miner had parked my family's white Mini, the place that he had died all alone, with a face the colour of pomegranate juice, aching for his lost money on the edge of the Hempstock land where the barriers between life and death were thin. I said, "I think we should wake up old Mrs. Hempstock."
"It doesn't work like that," said Letty. "When she gets tired, she sleeps until she wakes up on her own. A few minutes, or 100 years. There's no waking her. Might as well try and wake up an atom bomb."
Ginny Hempstock planted herself in the middle of the lane, facing away from the farmhouse.
"Right," she shouted to the night. "Let's be having you."
Nothing. A wet wind that gusted and was gone. Letty said, "Perhaps they've all gone home."
"Be nice if they had," said Ginny, "all this palaver and nonsense."
I felt guilty. It was, I knew, my fault. If I had kept hold of Letty's hand, none of this would have happened. Ursula Monkton, the Hunger Birds, these things were undoubtedly my responsibility. Even what had happened, or now had perhaps no longer happened, in the cold bath the previous night. I had a thought.
"Can't you just snip it out? The thing in my heart that they want. Maybe you could snip it out, like your granny snipped things last night."
Letty squeezed my hand in the dark. Maybe Gran could do that if she was here, she said. I can't. I don't think Mum can either. It's really hard, snipping things out of time. You have to make sure that the edges all line up, and even Gran doesn't always get it right. And this would be harder than that. It's a real thing. I don't think even Gran could take it out of you without hurting your heart. And you need your heart. And then she said, they're coming. But I knew something was happening, knew it before she said anything. For the second time, I saw the ground begin to glow golden. I watched the trees and the grass, the hedgerows and the willow clumps and the last stray daffodils begin to shine with a burnished half-light. I looked around, half fearful, half with wonder, and I observed that the light was brightest behind the house and over to the west, where the pond was. I heard the beating of mighty wings and a series of low thumps. I turned and I saw them, the vultures of the void, the carrion kind, the hunger birds. They were not shadows any longer, not here, not in this place. They were all too real, and they landed in the darkness just beyond the golden glow of the ground. They landed in the air and in trees, and they shuffled forward as close as they could get to the golden ground of the Hempstock's farm. They were huge. Each of them was much bigger than I was. I would have been hard-pressed to describe their faces, though. I could see them, look at them, take in every feature, but the moment I looked away they were gone, and there was nothing in my mind where the hunger birds had been but tearing beaks and talons, or wriggling tentacles, or hairy chitinous mandibles. I could not keep their true faces in my head. When I turned away, the only knowledge I retained was that they had been looking directly at me, and that they were ravenous. "Right, my proud beauties," said Ginny Hempstock loudly. Her hands were on the hips of her brown coat. "You can't stay here, you know that. Time to get a move on." And then she said simply, "Hop it." They shifted, but they did not move, the innumerable hunger birds, and began to make a noise. I thought that they were whispering amongst themselves, and then it seemed to me that the noise they were making was an amused chuckle. I heard their voices, distinct but twining together, so I could not tell which creature was speaking. "We are hunger birds. We have devoured palaces and worlds and kings and stars. We can stay wherever we wish to stay. We perform our function. We are necessary." And they laughed so loudly it sounded like a train approaching. I squeezed Letty's hand and she squeezed mine. "Give us the boy." Ginny said, "You're wasting your time and you're wasting mine. Go home." "We were summoned here. We do not need to leave until we have done what we came here for. We restore things to the way they are meant to be. Will you deprive us of our function?" "Of course I will," said Ginny. "You've had your dinner. Now you're just making nuisances of yourselves. Be off with you, blinking varmints. I wouldn't give tuppence halfpenny for the lot of you. Go home." And she shook her head in a flicking gesture. One of the creatures let out a long wailing scream of appetite and frustration. Letty's hold on my hand was firm. She said, "He's under our protection. He's on our land. And one step onto our land, and that's the end of you. So go away." The creatures seemed to huddle closer. There was silence in the Sussex night. Only the rustle of leaves in the wind, only the call of a distant owl, only the sigh of the breeze as it passed. But in that silence I could hear the hunger birds conferring, weighing up their options, plotting their course. And in that silence I felt their eyes upon me. Something in a tree flapped its huge wings and cried out, a shriek that mingled triumph and delight, an affirmative shout of hunger and joy. I felt something in my heart react to the scream like the tiniest splinter of ice inside my chest. "We cannot cross the border. This is true. We cannot take the child from your land. This also is true. We cannot hurt your farm or your creatures." "That's right, you can't. So get along with you. Go home. Haven't you got a war to be getting back to?" We cannot hurt your world, true. But we can hurt this one. One of the hunger birds reached a sharp beak down to the ground at its feet and began to tear at it, not as a creature that eats earth and grass, but as if it were eating a curtain or a piece of scenery with the world painted on it. Where it devoured the grass, nothing remained, a perfect nothing, only a color that reminded me of gray, but a formless, pulsing gray like the shifting static of our television screen when you dislodged the aerial cord and the picture had gone completely. This was the void. Not blackness, not nothingness. This was what lay beneath the thinly painted scrim of reality. And the hunger birds began to flap and to flock. They landed on a huge oak tree and they tore at it and they wolfed it down, and in moments the tree was gone, along with everything that had been behind it. A fox slipped out of a hedgerow and slunk down the lane, its eyes and mask and brush illuminated golden by the farm light. Before it had made it halfway across the road, it had been ripped from the world, and there was only void behind it. Letty said, "What he said before, we have to wake Gran." "She won't like that," said Jinny. "Might as well try and wake her." "Don't matter. If we can't wake her up, they'll destroy the whole of this creation." Jinny said only, "I don't know how." A clump of hunger birds flew up to a patch of the night sky where stars could be seen through the breaks in the clouds, and they tore at a kite-shaped constellation I could never have named, and they scratched and they rent and they gulped and they swallowed. In a handful of heartbeats, where the constellation and sky had been, there was now only a pulsing nothingness that hurt my eyes if I looked at it directly. I was a normal child, which is to say, I was selfish, and I was not entirely convinced of the existence of things that were not me, and I was certain, rock solid, unshakably certain, that I was the most important thing in creation. There was nothing that was more important to me than I was. Even so, I understood what I was seeing. The hunger birds would, no, they were, ripping the world away, tearing it into nothing. Soon enough, there would be no world. My mother, my father, my sister, my house, my school friends, my town, my grandparents, London, the Natural History Museum, France, television, books, ancient Egypt. Because of me, all these things would be gone, and there would be nothing in their place. I did not want to die. More than that, I did not want to die as Ursula Monkton had died, beneath the rending talons and beaks of things that may not even have had legs or faces. I did not want to die at all. Understand that. But I could not let everything be destroyed when I had it in my power to stop the destruction. I let go of Letty Hempstock's hand, and I ran as fast as I could, knowing that to hesitate, even to slow down, would be to change my mind, which would be the worst thing that I could do, which would be to save my life. How far did I run? Not far, I suppose, as these things go. Letty Hempstock was shouting at me to stop, but still I ran, crossing the farmland where every blade of grass, every pebble on the lane, every willow tree and hazel hedge glowed golden, and I ran toward the darkness beyond the Hempstock land. I ran, and I hated myself for running, as I had hated myself the time I had jumped from the high board at the swimming pool. I knew there was no going back, that there was no way that this could end in anything but pain. And I knew that I was willing to exchange my life for the world. They took off into the air, the hunger birds, as I ran toward them, as pigeons will rise when you run at them. They wheeled and they circled, deep shadows in the dark. I stood there in the darkness and I waited for them to descend. I waited for their beaks to tear up my chest and for them to devour my heart. I stood there for perhaps 2 heartbeats, and it felt like forever. It happened.
Something slammed into me from behind and knocked me down into the mud on the side of the lane, face first. I saw bursts of light that were not there. The ground hit my stomach and the wind was knocked out of me. A ghost memory rises here. A phantom moment. A shaky reflection in the pool of remembrance. I know how it would have felt when the scavengers took my heart. How it felt as the hunger birds, all mouth, tore into my chest and snatched out my heart, still pumping, and devoured it to get at what was hidden inside. I know how that feels, as if it was truly a part of my life, of my death. And then the memory snips and rips neatly, and a voice said, "Idiot, don't move, just don't." And the voice was Letty Hempstock's, and I could not have moved if I had wanted to. She was on top of me, and she was heavier than I was, and she was pushing me down, face first, into the grass and the wet earth, and I could see nothing. I felt them, though. I felt them crash into her. She was holding me down, making herself a barrier between me and the world. I heard Letty's voice wail in pain. I felt her shudder and twitch. There were ugly cries of triumph and hunger, and I could hear my own voice whimpering and sobbing so loud in my ears. A voice said, "This is unacceptable." It was a familiar voice, but still I could not place it or move to see who was talking. Letty was on top of me, still shaking, but as the voice spoke, she stopped moving. The voice continued, "On what authority do you harm my child?" A pause, then, "She was between us and our lawful prey." "You're scavengers, eaters of offal, of rubbish, of garbage, you're cleaners. Do you think that you can harm my family?" I knew who was talking. The voice sounded like Letty's gran, like old Mrs. Hempstock. Like her, I knew, and yet so unlike. If old Mrs. Hempstock had been an empress, she might have talked like that, her voice more stilted and formal and yet more musical than the old lady voice I knew. Something wet and warm was soaking my back. "No, no, lady." That was the first time I heard fear or doubt in the voice of one of the hunger birds. "There are pacts, and there are laws, and there are treaties, and you have violated all of them." Silence then, and it was louder than words could have been. They had nothing to say. I felt Letty's body being rolled off mine, and I looked up to see Ginny Hempstock's sensible face. She sat on the ground on the edge of the road, and I buried my face in her bosom. She took me in one arm, and her daughter in the other. From the shadows, a hunger bird spoke with a voice that was not a voice, and it said only, "We are sorry for your loss." "Sorry?" The word was spat, not said. Ginny Hempstock swayed from side to side, crooning low and wordlessly to me and to her daughter. Her arms were around me. I lifted my head and I looked back at the person speaking, my vision blurred by tears. I stared at her. It was old Mrs. Hempstock, I suppose. But it wasn't. It was Letty's gran in the same way that, I mean, she shone silver. Her hair was still long, still white, but now she stood as tall and as straight as a teenager. My eyes had become too used to the darkness, and I could not look at her face to see if it was the face I was familiar with. It was too bright. Magnesium flare bright, fireworks night bright, midday sun reflecting off a silver coin bright. I looked at her as long as I could bear to look, and then I turned my head, screwing my eyes tightly shut, unable to see anything but a pulsating afterimage. The voice that was like old Mrs. Hempstock's said, "Shall I bind you creatures in the heart of a dark star, to feel your pain in a place where every fragment of a moment lasts 1,000 years?
Shall I invoke the compacts of creation and have you all removed from the list of created things so there never will have been any hunger birds, and anything that wishes to traipse from world to world can do it with impunity?
I listened for a reply, but heard nothing. Only a whimper, a mewl of pain or of frustration.
I'm done with you. I will deal with you in my own time and in my own way. For now, I must tend to the children.
Yes, lady. Thank you, lady.
Not so fast. Nobody's going anywhere before you put all those things back like they was. There's Boötes missing from the sky. There's an oak tree gone, and a fox. You put them all back the way they were.
And then the silvery empress voice added, in a voice that was now also unmistakably old Mrs. Hempstock's,
"Varmints!"
Somebody was humming a tune. I realized, as if from a long way away, that it was me, at the same moment that I remembered what the tune was. Girls and boys come out to play.
The moon doth shine as bright as day. Leave your supper and leave your meat, and join your playfellows in the street. Come with a whoop and come with a call, come with a whole heart or not at all.
I held on to Ginny Hempstock. She smelled like a farm and like a kitchen, like animals and like food. She smelled very real, and the realness was what I needed at that moment. I reached out a hand, tentatively touched Letty's shoulder. She did not move or respond. Ginny started speaking then, but at first I did not know if she was talking to herself, or to Letty, or to me. "They overstepped their bounds," she said. "They could have hurt you, child, and it would have meant nothing. They could have hurt this world without anything being said. It's only a world, after all, and they're just sand grains in the desert, worlds. But Letty's a Hempstock. She's outside of their dominion, my little one. And they hurted her." I looked at Letty. Her head had flopped down, hiding her face. Her eyes were closed.
"Is she going to be all right?" I asked.
Ginny didn't reply, just hugged us both the tighter to her bosom and rocked and crooned a wordless song. The farm and its land no longer glowed golden. I could not feel anything in the shadows watching me, not any longer.
"Don't you worry," said an old voice, now familiar once more. "You're safe as houses, safer than most houses I've seen. They've gone."
"They'll come back again," I said. "They want my heart."
"They'd not come back to this world again for all the tea in China," said old Mrs. Hempstock. "Not that they've got any use for tea, or for China, no more than a carrion crow does."
Why had I thought her dressed in silver? She wore a much-patched grey dressing gown over what had to have been a nightie, but a nightie of a kind that had not been fashionable for several hundred years. The old woman put a hand on her granddaughter's pale forehead, lifted it up, then let it go. Letty's mother shook her head. "It's over," she said. I understood it then, at the last, and felt foolish for not understanding it sooner. The girl clapped in. He was wearing his dressing gown over his pajamas. He often cooked breakfast on Saturdays. I said, "Dad, where's my comic?" He always bought me a copy of Smash before he drove home from work on Fridays, and I would read it on Saturday mornings. "In the back of the car. Do you want toast?"
"Yes," I said, "but not burnt."
My father did not like toasters. He toasted bread under the grill, and usually he burnt it. I went outside into the drive. I looked around. I went back into the house, pushed the kitchen door, went in. I liked the kitchen door. It swung both ways, in and out, so servants 60 years ago would be able to walk in or out with their arms laden with dishes empty or full.
"Dad, where's the car?"
"In the drive."
"No, it isn't."
"What?"
The telephone rang, and my father went out into the hall, where the phone was, to answer it. I heard him talking to someone. The toast began to smoke under the grill.
I got up on a chair and turned the grill off.
That was the police, my father said. Someone's reported seeing our car abandoned at the bottom of the lane. I said I hadn't even reported it stolen yet. Right, we can head down now, meet them there. Toast!
He pulled the pan out from beneath the grill. The toast was smoking and blackened on one side.
Is my comic there? Or did they steal it?
I don't know. The police didn't mention your comic.
My father put peanut butter on the burnt side of each piece of toast, replaced his dressing gown with a coat worn over his pajamas, put on a pair of shoes, and we walked down the lane together. He munched his toast as we walked. I held my toast and did not eat it. We had walked for perhaps 5 minutes down the narrow lane which ran through fields on each side, when a police car came up behind us. It slowed, and the driver greeted my father by name. I hid my piece of burnt toast behind my back while my father talked to the policeman. I wished my family would buy normal sliced white bread, the kind that went into toasters like every other family I knew. My father had found a local baker's shop where they made thick loaves of heavy brown bread, and he insisted on buying them. He said they tasted better, which was, to my mind, nonsense. Proper bread was white and pre-sliced and tasted like almost nothing. That was the point. The driver of the police car got out, opened the passenger door, told me to get in. My father rode up front beside the driver. The police car went slowly down the lane. The whole lane was unpaved back then, just wide enough for one car at a time, a puddly, precipitous, bumpy way with flints sticking up from it, the whole thing rutted by farm equipment and rain and time.
"These kids," said the policeman, "they think it's funny. Steal a car, drive it around, abandon it. They'll be locals."
"I'm just glad it was found so fast," said my father. Past Caraway Farm, where a small girl with hair so blonde it was almost white and red cheeks stared at us as we went past. I held my piece of burnt toast on my lap.
"Funny them leaving it down here, though," said the policeman, "because it's a long walk back to anywhere from here."
We passed a bend in the lane and saw the white Mini over on the side in front of a gate leading into a field, tires sunk deep in the brown mud. We drove past it, parked on the grass verge. The policeman let me out, and the three of us walked over to the Mini, while the policeman told my dad about crime in this area and why it was obviously the local kids had done it. Then my dad was opening the passenger side door with his spare key. He said, "Someone left something on the back seat." My father reached back and pulled the blue blanket away that covered the thing in the back seat, even as the policeman was telling him that he shouldn't do that, and I was staring at the back seat, because that was where my comic was. So I saw it. It was an it, the thing I was looking at, not a him. Although I was an imaginative child, prone to nightmares, I had persuaded my parents to take me to Madame Tussaud's waxworks in London when I was 6 because I had wanted to visit the Chamber of Horrors, expecting the movie monster Chamber of Horrors I'd read about in my comics. I had wanted to thrill to waxworks of Dracula and Frankenstein's monster and the Wolfman. Instead, I was walked through a seemingly endless sequence of dioramas of unremarkable, glum-looking men and women who had murdered people, usually lodgers and members of their own families, and who were then murdered in their turn by hanging by the electric chair in gas chambers. Most of them were depicted with their victims in awkward social situations, seated around a dinner table, perhaps, as their poisoned family members expired. The plaques that explained who they were also told me that the majority of them had murdered their families and sold the bodies to anatomy. It was then that the word anatomy garnered its own edge of horror for me. I did not know what anatomy was. I knew only that anatomy made people kill their children. The only thing that had kept me from running screaming from the Chamber of Horrors as I was led around it was that none of the waxworks had looked fully convincing. They could not truly look dead, because they did not ever look alive. The thing in the back seat that had been covered by the blue blanket, I knew that blanket. It was the one that had been in my old bedroom on the shelf for when it got cold, was not convincing either. It looked a little like the opal miner, but it was dressed in a black suit with a white ruffled shirt and a black bow tie. Its hair was slicked back and artificially shiny. Its eyes were staring. Its lips were bluish, but its skin was very red. It looked like a parody of health. There was no gold chain around its neck. I could see, underneath it, crumpled and bent, my copy of Smash, with Batman looking just as he did on the television, on the cover. I don't remember who said what then, just that they made me stand away from the mini. I crossed the road, and I stood there on my own while the policeman talked to my father and wrote things down in a notebook. I stared at the mini. A length of green garden hose ran from the exhaust pipe up to the driver's window. There was thick brown mud all over the exhaust, holding the hose pipe in place. Nobody was watching me. I took a bite of my toast. It was burnt and cold. At home, my father ate all the most burnt pieces of toast. Yum, he'd say, and charcoal, good for you, and burnt toast, my favourite, and he'd eat it all up. When I was much older, he confessed to me that he had not ever liked burnt toast. Had beside me on her mother's lap at her mother's breast had given her life for mine. They were meant to hurt me, not her, I said. No reason they should have taken either of you, said the old lady with a sniff. I felt guilt then, guilt beyond anything I had ever felt before. We should get her to a hospital, I said hopefully. We can call a doctor, maybe they can make her better. Ginny shook her head. Is she dead? I asked. Dead? Repeated the old woman in the dressing gown. She sounded offended. Has hif, she said, grandly aspirating each H as if that were the only way to convey the gravity of her words to me. Has hif an impstock would hiver do anything so common. She's hurt, said Ginny Hempstock, cuddling me close, hurt as badly as she can be hurt. She's so close to death as makes no odds if we don't do something about it, and quickly. A final hug, then. Off with you now. I clambered reluctantly from her lap, and I stood up. Ginny Hempstock got to her feet, her daughter's body limp in her arms. Letty lolled and was jogged like a rag doll as her mother got up, and I stared at her, shocked beyond measure. I said, "It was my fault. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry." Old Mrs. Hempstock said, "You meant well." But Ginny Hempstock said nothing at all. She walked down the lane toward the farm, and then she turned off behind the milking shed. I thought that Letty was too big to be carried, but Ginny carried her as if she weighed no more than a kitten, her head and upper body resting on Ginny's shoulder like a sleeping infant being taken upstairs to bed. Ginny carried her down that path and beside the hedge and back, until we reached the pond. There were no breezes back there, and the night was perfectly still. Our path was lit by moonlight and nothing more. The pond, when we got there, was just a pond. No golden, glimmering light, no magical full moon. It was black and dull, with the moon, the true moon, the quarter moon, reflected in it. I stopped at the edge of the pond, and old Mrs. Hempstock stopped beside me. But Ginny Hempstock kept walking. She staggered down into the pond until she was wading thigh-deep, her coat and skirt floating on the water as she waded, breaking the reflected moon into dozens of tiny moons that scattered and reformed around her. At the center of the pond, with the black water above her hips, she stopped. She took Letty from her shoulder, so the girl's body was supported at the head and at the knees by Ginny Hempstock's practical hands. Then slowly, so very slowly, she laid Letty down in the water. The girl's body floated on the surface of the pond. Ginny took a step back and then another, never looking away from her daughter.
I heard a rushing noise, as if of an enormous wind coming toward us. Letty's body shook. There was no breeze, but now there were white caps on the surface of the pond. I saw waves, gentle lapping waves at first, and then bigger waves that broke and slapped at the edge of the pond. One wave crested and crashed down close to me, splashing my clothes and face. I could taste the water's wetness on my lips, and it was salt. I whispered, "I'm sorry, Letty." I should have been able to see the other side of the pond. I had seen it a few moments before, but the crashing waves had taken it away, and I could see nothing beyond Letty's floating body but the vastness of the lonely ocean and the dark. The waves grew bigger. The water began to glow in the moonlight, as it had glowed when it was in a bucket, glowed a pale, perfect blue. The black shape on the surface of the water was the body of the girl who had saved my life. Bony fingers rested on my shoulder. "What are you apologizing for, boy? For killing her?" I nodded, not trusting myself to speak. "She's not dead. You didn't kill her, nor did the Hunger Birds, although they did their best to get to you through her. She's been given to her ocean. One day, in its own time, the ocean will give her back." I thought of corpses, and of skeletons with pearls for eyes. I thought of mermaids with tails that flicked when they moved, like my goldfish's tails had flicked before my goldfish had stopped moving, to lie, belly up, like Letty, on the top of the water. I said, "Will she be the same?" The old woman guffawed, as if I had said the funniest thing in the universe. "Nothing's ever the same," she said, "be it a second later or 100 years. It's always churning and roiling, and people change as much as oceans." Ginny clambered out of the water, and she stood at the water's edge beside me, her head bowed. The waves crashed and smacked and splashed and retreated. There was a distant rumble that became a louder and louder rumble. Something was coming toward us across the ocean. From miles away, from hundreds and hundreds of miles away it came, a thin white line etched in the glowing blue, and it grew as it approached. The great wave came, and the world rumbled, and I looked up as it reached us. It was taller than trees, than houses, than mind or eyes could hold or heart could follow. Only when it reached Letty Hempstock's floating body did the enormous wave crash down. I expected to be soaked, or worse, to be swept away by the angry ocean water, and I raised my arm to cover my face. There was no splash of breakers, no deafening crash, and when I lowered my arm I could see nothing but the still black water of a pond in the night, and there was nothing on the surface of the pond, but a smattering of lily pads and the thoughtful, incomplete reflection of the moon. Old Mrs. Hempstock was gone too. I had thought that she was standing beside me, but only Ginny stood there, next to me, staring down silently into the dark mirror of the little pond. "Right," she said, "I'll take you home." Chapter 15. There was a Land Rover parked behind the cowshed. The doors were open and the ignition key was in the lock. I sat on the newspaper-covered passenger seat and watched Ginny Hempstock turn the key. The engine sputtered a few times before it started. I had 15. There was a Land Rover, parked behind the cowshed. The doors were open and the ignition key was in the lock. I sat on the newspaper-covered passenger seat and watched Ginny Hempstock turn the key. The engine sputtered a few times before it started. I had not imagined any of the Hempstocks driving. I said, "I didn't know you had a car." "Lots of things you don't know," said Mrs. Hempstock tartly. Then she glanced at me more gently and said, "You can't know everything." She backed the Land Rover up, and it bumped its way forward across the ruts and the puddles of the back of the farmyard. There was something on my mind. "Old Mrs. Hempstock says that Letty isn't really dead," I said. "But she looked dead. I think she is actually dead. I don't think it's true, but she's not dead." Ginny looked like she was going to say something about the nature of truth. But all she said was, "Letty's hurt. Very badly hurt. The ocean has taken her. Honestly, I don't know if it will ever give her back. But we can hope, can't we?" "Yes." I squeezed my hands into fists, and I hoped as hard as I knew how. We bumped and jolted up the lane at 15 miles per hour. I said, Is she really your daughter?" I didn't know. I still don't know why I asked her that. Perhaps I just wanted to know more about the girl who had saved my life, who had rescued me more than once. I didn't know anything about her. "More or less," said Ginny. "The men Hempstocks, my brothers, they went out into the world, and they had babies who've had babies. There are Hempstock women out there in your world, and I'll wager each of them is a wonder in her own way. But only Gran and me and Letty are the pure thing." "She didn't have a daddy?" I asked. "No." "Did you have a daddy?" "You're all questions, aren't you?" "No, love. We never went in for that sort of thing. You only need men if you want to breed more men." I said, "You don't have to take me home. I could stay with you. I could wait until Letty comes back from the ocean. I could work on your farm and carry stuff and learn to drive a tractor." She said, "No." But she said it kindly. "You get on with your own life. Letty gave it to you. You just have to grow up and try and be worth it." A flash of resentment. It's hard enough being alive, trying to survive in the world and find your place in it, to do the things you need to do to get by, without wondering if the thing you just did, whatever it was worth someone having, if not died, then having given up her life. It wasn't fair. "Life's not fair," said Ginny, as if I had spoken aloud. She turned into our driveway, pulled up outside the front door. I got out, and she did too. "Better make it easier for you to go home," she said. Mrs. Hempstock rang the doorbell, although the door was never locked, and industriously scraped the soles of her Wellington boots on the doormat until my mother opened the door. She was dressed for bed and wearing her quilted pink dressing gown. "Here he is," said Ginny, "safe and sound, the soldier back from the wars. He had a lovely time at our Letty's going away party, but now it's time for this young man to get his rest." My mother looked blank, almost confused, and then the confusion was replaced by a smile, as if the world had just reconfigured itself into a form that made sense. "Oh, you didn't have to bring him back," said my mother. "One of us would have come and picked him up." Then she looked down at me. "What do you say to Mrs. Hempstock, darling?" I said it automatically. "Thank you for having me." My mother said, "Very good, dear." Then, "Letty's going away." "To Australia," said Ginny, "to be with her father. We'll miss having this little fellow over to play, but well, we'll let you know when Letty comes back. You can come over and play then." I was getting tired.
The party had been fun, although I could not remember much about it. I knew that I would not visit the Hempstock farm again, though. Not unless Letty was there. Australia was a long, long way away. I wondered how long it would be until she came back from Australia with her father. Years, I supposed. Australia was on the other side of the world, across the ocean. A small part of my mind remembered an alternate pattern of events and then lost it, as if I had woken from a comfortable sleep and looked around, pulled the bedclothes over me, and returned to my dream. Mrs. Hempstock got back into her ancient Land Rover, so bespattered with mud I could now see in the light above the front door that there was almost no trace of the original paintwork visible, and she backed it up, down the drive, toward the lane. My mother seemed unbothered that I had returned home in fancy dress clothes at almost 11 at night. She said, "I have some bad news, dear." "What's that?" "Ursula's had to leave. Family matters, pressing family matters. She's already left. I know how much you children liked her." I knew that I didn't like her, but I said nothing. There was now nobody sleeping in my bedroom at the top of the stairs. My mother asked if I would like my room back for a while. I said no, unsure of why I was saying no. I could not remember why I disliked Ursula Monkton so much. Indeed, I felt faintly guilty for disliking her so absolutely and so irrationally. But I had no desire to return to that bedroom, despite the little yellow handbasin just my size, and I remained in the shared bedroom until our family moved out of that house half a decade later. We children protesting, the adults, I think, just relieved that their financial difficulties were over. The house was demolished after we moved out. I would not go and see it standing empty and refused to witness the demolition. There was too much of my life bound up in those bricks and tiles, those drain pipes and walls. Years later, my sister, now an adult herself, confided in me that she believed that our mother had fired Ursula Monkton, whom she remembered so fondly as the only nice one in a sequence of grumpy childminders, because our father was having an affair with her. It was possible, I agreed. Our parents were still alive then, and I could have asked them. But I didn't. My father did not mention the events of those nights. Not then, not later. I finally made friends with my father when I entered my 20s. We had so little in common when I was a boy, and I am certain I had been a disappointment to him. He did not ask for a child with a book, off in its own world. He wanted a son who did what he had done, swam and boxed and played rugby, and drove cars at speed with abandon and joy. But that was not what he had wound up with. I did not ever go down the lane, all the way to the end. I did not think of the White Mini. When I thought of the opal miner, it was in context of the two rough raw opal rocks that sat on our mantelpiece, and in my memory, he always wore a checked shirt and jeans. His face and arms were tan, not the cherry red of monoxide poisoning, and he had no bow tie. Monster, the ginger tomcat the opal miner had left us, had wandered off to be fed by other families, and although we saw him from time to time prowling the ditches and trees at the end of the lane, he would not ever come when we called. I was relieved by this, I think. He had never been our cat. We knew it, and so did he. A story only matters, I suspect, to the extent that the people in the story change. But I was 7 when all of these things happened, and I was the same person at the end of it that I was at the beginning, wasn't I? So was everyone else. They must have been. People don't change. Some things changed, though. A month or so after the events here, and 5 years before the ramshackle world I lived in was demolished and replaced by trim, squat, regular houses containing smart young people who worked in the city but lived in my town, who made money by moving money from place to place but who did not build or dig or farm or weave, and 9 years before I would kiss smiling Callie Anders, I came home from school. The month was May, or perhaps early June. She was waiting by the back door, as if she knew precisely where she was and who she was looking for. A young black cat, a little larger than a kitten now, with a white splodge over one ear, and with eyes of an intense and unusual greenish-blue. She followed me into the house. I fed her with an unused can of Monster's cat food, which I spooned into Monster's dusty cat bowl. My parents, who had never noticed the Ginger Tom's disappearance, did not initially notice the arrival of the new kitten cat, and by the time my father commented on her existence, she had been living with us for several weeks, exploring the garden until I came home from school, then staying near me while I read or played. At night she would wait beneath the bed until the lights were turned out. Then she would accommodate herself on the pillow beside me, grooming my hair and purring so quietly as never to disturb my sister. I would fall asleep with my face pressed into her fur, while her deep electrical purr vibrated softly against my cheek. She had such unusual eyes. They made me think of the seaside, and so I called her Ocean, and could not have told you why. Epilogue. I sat on the dilapidated green bench beside the duck pond in the back of the red brick farmhouse, and I thought about my kitten. I only remembered that Ocean had grown into a cat, and that I had adored her for years. I wondered what had happened to her, and then I thought, it doesn't matter that I can't remember the details any longer. Death happened to her. Death happens to all of us. A door opened in the farmhouse, and I heard feet on the path. Soon the old woman sat down beside me. "I brung you a cup of tea," she said, "and a cheese and tomato sandwich. You've been out here for quite a while. I thought you'd probably fallen in." "I sort of did," I told her, "and thank you." It had become dusk without my noticing while I had been sitting there. I took the tea and sipped it, and I looked at the woman more carefully this time. I compared her to my memories of 40 years ago. I said, "You aren't Letty's mother. You're her grandmother, aren't you? You're old Mrs. Hempstock." "That's right," she said, unperturbed. "Eat your sandwich." I took a bite of my sandwich. It was good, really good. Freshly baked bread, sharp, salty cheese, the kind of tomatoes that actually taste like something. I was awash in memory, and I wanted to know what it all meant. I said, "Is it true?" and felt foolish. Of all the questions I could have asked, I had asked that. Old Mrs. Hempstock shrugged. "What you remembered? Probably, more or less. Different people remember things differently, and you'll not get any two people to remember anything the same, whether they were there or not. You stand two of you lot next to each other, and you could be continents away for all it means anything." There was another question I needed answered. I said, "Why did I come here?" She looked at me as if it were a trick question. "The funeral," she said. "You wanted to get away from everyone and be on your own. So first of all you drove back to the place you'd lived in as a boy, and when that didn't give you what you missed, you drove to the end of the lane. And you came here, like you always do." Like I always do. I drank some more tea. It was still hot and strong enough, a perfect cup of builder's tea. You could stand a spoon straight up in it, as my father always said of a cup of tea, of which he approved. "Like you always do," she repeated. "No," I said, "you're wrong. I mean, I haven't been here since Letty went to Australia, her going away party." And then I said, "Which never happened. You know what I mean." "You come back sometimes," she said. "You were here once when you were 24. I remember. You had 2 young children, and you were so scared. You came here before you left this part of the world. You were what?
In your 30s, then? I fed you a good meal in the kitchen, and you told me about your dreams and the art you were making. I don't remember. She pushed the hair from her eyes. It's easier that way. I sipped my tea and finished the sandwich. The mug was white, and so was the plate. The endless summer evening was coming to an end. I asked her again, "Why did I come here?" "Letty wanted you to," said somebody. The person who said that was walking around the pond, a woman in a brown coat wearing Wellington boots. I looked at her in confusion. She looked younger than I was now. I remembered her as vast as adult, but now I saw she was only in her late 30s. I remembered her as stout, but she was buxom and attractive in an apple-cheeked sort of a way. She was still Ginny Hempstock, Letty's mother, and she looked, I was certain, just as she had looked 40-something years ago. She sat down on the bench on the other side of me, so I was flanked by Hempstock women. She said, "I think Letty just wants to know if it was worth it." "If what was worth it?"
"You,"
said the old woman, tartly. "Letty did a very big thing for you," said Ginny. "I think she mostly wants to find out what happened next and whether it was worth everything she did." "She sacrificed herself for me."
"After a fashion, dear," said Ginny.
"The hunger birds tore out your heart. You screamed so piteously as you died. She couldn't abide that. She had to do something." I tried to remember this. I said, "That isn't how I remember it." I thought about my heart then, wondered if there was a cold fragment of a doorway inside it still, and if it was a gift or a curse, if there was. The old lady sniffed.
"Didn't I just say you'll never get any two people to remember anything the same?" she asked.
"Can I talk to her? To Letty?" "She's sleeping," said Letty's mother. "She's healing. She's not talking yet."
"Not until she's all done with where she is," said Letty's grandmother, gesturing, but I could not tell if she was pointing to the duck pond or to the sky.
"When will that be?"
"When she's good and ready," said the old woman, as her daughter said, "Soon."
"Well," I said, "if she brought me here to look at me, let her look at me." And even as I said it, I knew that it had already happened. How long had I been sitting on that bench, staring into the pond? As I had been remembering her, she had been examining me.
"Oh, she did already, didn't she?"
"Yes, dear."
"And did I pass?"
The face of the old woman on my right was unreadable in the gathering dusk. On my left, the younger woman said, "You don't pass or fail at being a person, dear." I put the empty cup and plate down on the ground. Ginny Hempstock said, "I think you're doing better than you were the last time we saw you. You're growing a new heart, for a start." In my memory, she was a mountain, this woman, and I had sobbed and shivered on her bosom. Now she was smaller than I was, and I could not imagine her comforting me. Not in that way. The moon was full in the sky above the pond. I could not for the life of me remember what phase the moon had been in the last time I had noticed it. I could not actually remember the last time I had done more than glance at the moon.
"So what will happen now?"
"Same thing as happens every other time you've come here," said the old woman. "You go home."
"I don't know where that is anymore," I told them.
"You always say that," said Ginny.
In my head, Letty Hempstock was still a full head taller than I was. She was 11, after all. I wondered what I would see, who I would see, if she stood before me now. The moon in the duck pond was full as well, and I found myself unbidden thinking of the holy fools in the old story, the ones who had gone fishing in a lake for the moon with nets, convinced that the reflection in the water was nearer and easier to catch than the globe that hung in the sky. And of course, It always is. I got up and walked a few steps to the edge of the pond. Letty, I said aloud, trying to ignore the two women behind me. Thank you for saving my life. She should never have taken you with her in the first place when she went off to find the start of it all, sniffed old Mrs. Hempstock. Nothing to stop her sorting it all out on her own. Didn't need to take you along for company, silly thing. Well, that'll learn her for next time. I turned and looked at old Mrs. Hempstock. Do you really remember?